9A1. Thank you, Elaine. As I mentioned to you last time, we were going to skip over a few things and pick up on the Talmud's discussion of the second of the ways of conducting Kiddushin. We had Kesef, and now we will look at Shtar, the use of a document in order to perform the ceremony of Kiddushin. So this is 9A1 on the right side of the page, halfway down. Tanu Rabbanan. Bishtar Ketzad. Okay, the last time it was Bekesef Ketzad. How do you do it with money? Now the question is, how do you do it with a document? Bishtar Ketzad. Katav lo al hanyar, o al hacheres. If the husband, namely the one who was going the male part of this marriage ceremony, wrote to her, katav lo, the Rashi and the English translation has it differently. Katav lo means he, namely the groom, wrote to him, namely the father of the bride. We are dealing with a child bride here, where the father has the right to accept the kiddushin. Okay? So that's the way this baraita is understood. So, katav lo alanyar, if he, the groom, wrote it to the father on enyar, on paper, o alacheres. Interestingly, this can be done on a potsherd as well. Af al pi she'en bo shaveh pruta. Right? This piece of paper, or this potsherd, is not worth a pruta. That is to say that the giving of the object itself, because you might say that this is just going to be another form of kesef. If the paper is worth a pruta, or the kli cheres is worth a pruta, then you remember that the first form of kiddushin, the kesef, with money, can be done with either kesef or shaveh kesef, either money or something that is equivalent to money, namely something that has value, something that has equivalent value. So here it's important to say that the paper itself doesn't have any value. So this is not by any means a kiddushin that's done bekesef, because it's something that isn't worth a pruta. And he writes on it the following. Bitcha mikudeshetli. Okay, that's why it has to be he wrote it to him, namely the father. Because he says here, your daughter is betrothed to me, is bekudeshet to me. Bitcha maoresetli. These are the same things that we saw with Kesef. Your daughter is maoreset. Bitcha lila intu. Your daughter is to me a wife, will become my wife. Hare zo mekudeshet. She is mekudeshet. So here you see that the procedure is somewhat the same. It does require a formula. And of course, that's the very nature of a written document, is that a written document is a written document. You write down something. And it matters what you write down, because if the content of the document is what's crucial, then you have to write down the right thing. So it's not the fact of the document, but the content of the document that's crucial here, as is the way of documents. Right? Now, Rabbi Zera Bar Mamel questions this. He attacks it. Matkifla always means that some Amora now is going to raise an objection with a Baraita that we have just seen. They raise it either based on logic or based on another Baraita. Matkifla Rabbi Zera Bar Mamo, halo dame haishtara lishtar zevine. He raises a very good objection. He says, look, this document that we're talking about is a document that is a document of sale, in effect. Okay? there is an analogy here. We've said many, many times that this is a procedure of kinyan. And kinyan, at least structurally, is a subject of sale. Something changes status as a result of that. And you would think of all things that the kinyan that is done by a document would at least follow the same procedures as the procedures are when you make a kinyan by a document, when you're making a purchase by a document. Here we analyze a very interesting. There's a problem with this. It should be that this document is like that. Hailadame. This document, what you just said to me in the Baraita, is not like a bill of sale. Now, he's going to explain what he means. What's wrong with that? Hatam mocher. Hatam. There, in the case of a bill of sale. Mocher kotev lo sadi mechura lecha. The seller writes, okay, the formal nature of a bill of sale, that is a kosher bill of sale to create a kinyan of the transfer of land, and it is a written document that transfers land. We already saw that a written document doesn't transfer movable objects. It does transfer, it is good for land transfers. Right? There, Mocher, the seller, Kotevlo, writes to the buyer a document of sale that says the following. Sadim mechura lecha. My field is sold to you. So the seller writes it to the buyer. That's the formal bill of sale. Hacha, but here, in the case of the Baraita, Baal kotev bidcha mikudeshetli. Here, it's in fact functions the opposite way. The Baal, in fact, the buyer, formally speaking, if we're going to create an analogy between a sale and a marriage, the analogy is as follows. It is the groom who is the buyer. He pays for the wife, as it were. Right? He gives money. So he's the one who is, at least formalistically here, right, he is seen as the buyer, not the seller. He's seen as the buyer, not the hacha ba'al kotev. But in this case, the owner writes the document, right? The husband-to-be, the husband-to-be, Baal, the husband-to-be writes the document, and he writes, Bitcha mekudeshetli, your daughter is betrothed to me. So it says, how then does the Tana know that the Kiddushin document he describes qualifies as a legal document? Right? It's the opposite of what we just learned above in the Baraita. Baraita says it has to be a document written by the seller. Here, it's a document. The seller is, in effect, the father, not the husband. The husband's the buyer. Here it says that as far as a marriage goes, the husband writes the document. So it doesn't follow the formal bill of sale. And if you tell me that this is a shtar, we know how shtarot work. We know how they work, and we would expect the analogy to follow. Okay, Amar Rava. Rava is always a key player here. We've seen that for many, many weeks, that Rava is a major, major player in this chapter. Rava suggests the following. Hatam mi inyana dekra, the hacha mi inyana dekra. There, as far as a bill of sale goes, why is it the seller who writes a bill of sale? It's because of the way bills of sale are spoken of in the Torah. Very often this is the case. You know, because you would say to yourself, why should a bill of sale be written by this party and not that party? No, there are two possible reasons for that. Either it's a logical reason, then we'd have to see what the logic is, or it's a textual reason. So much of the law goes back to the way it's formulated in the original text, in the constitutional text here of the Torah. So Rava says, Hatam, there, as far as the bill of sale goes, me inyana dekra. It is based on the scriptural source. And the scriptural source, as he will tell us, must be that the seller, the seller writes the document. The hacha, here in the marriage ceremony, mi'inyana dekra, it also is based on the scriptural verse. And therefore, it doesn't follow each one. One is not analogous to the other, because there are two different scriptural sources. Right? Hatam ketiv, there, as far as the bill of sale is concerned, it is written in the Torah. Umachar me'achuzato, and he sells a part of his ancestral heritage, his holdings, literally. Achuzah is his holdings. So he sells a part of his holdings, namely the seller. This is talking about the forms of sale. So the seller, he sells part of it. B'mocher tala rachmana. The Torah itself structures the thing vis-a-vis the seller. U'machar me'achuzato. He sells from his possession. B'mocher tala rachmana. Hachaketiv, but here it is written, here namely in terms of the marriage, it is written differently. Ki yikach ish isha. When a man takes a wife, and there yikach can be purchases. Right? So it's a different form of purchase. The man, namely the husband, is the one who initiates the purchase of the wife, as it were. So you have two different verses, and in response to the two different verses, you have two different procedures. That's Rava's explanation of the difference between the two braitot. That's a good explanation. Okay? Any questions so far? So far, so good. Okay? We're 982. Yes?
In the shtar, they don't have identity, like names of who is who? No names?
That's an interesting question. The answer is they don't. You don't have to.
So if somebody finds a shtar, you can claim the
one. Oh, not necessarily. No. You just hold your horses, because that's exactly correct. That could be the problem, which is why you can't use a shtar that you find. The shtar has to be written then and there, in the place, right, correct, everything has to be witnessed, then and there, and you'll see that exactly this point is going to be raised in the Gemara coming up, because you're right. That also is going to be in the Gemara, okay? That is going to be the problems the Gemara is going to raise. You're sensitive exactly to the issue.
So the witnesses would be named in the shtar, but not the...
No, they don't have to be named in the shtar, they just have to be present. They have to be present for this.
But how you? Well,
how do you prove it? Same thing. How do you prove with Kesef? Kesef. Let's say Kesef.
Kesef. You have transaction of.
All right. So the two witnesses are there. They see the Kesef go from one hand to another. The two witnesses there. They see the person write the shtar and give it to the wife. Same thing. That's it's analogous. Okay.
May I ask?
Yes, sir.
When we have a marriage ceremony here, we say. We ask by name the participants, do you take this individual as a wife? Do you take this? Absenting a civil authority, would a Jewish marriage involve that?
Nope. What you just described?
You wouldn't have naming the parties.
Nope.
Under the chuppah.
Nope. As a matter of fact, somebody is going to write a paper on this someday. To show the Americanization of the American rabbinate. A very interesting paper to use the wedding ceremony as the context of showing the extent to which the rabbinate adopted essentially Protestant procedures for weddings or rejected them. And I've seen it in my own rabbinate, the way in which those procedures have changed. Years ago, I was of the young firebrand group of people that refused to do Protestant weddings, or at least to structure a Jewish wedding like a Protestant wedding. So do you take this to be your honor, or your lawfully wedded wife? do you take, you know, the I, and the I do's, they're called the I do's. In the pro, in the profession, you call these the I do's. So, we were, years, my time, we were rebels against the I do's, because the I do's were Protestant. They're basically Protestant procedure. And we felt that, you know, the Jewish wedding ceremony should be a Jewish event and not an event that was Protestant. So in the early years of my rabbinate, it was actually an issue, because the lay people would sometimes give me a hard time, because they wanted to have a ceremony with I do's. Today it's exactly the opposite. Today it's exactly the opposite. The young people today don't want anything to do with that, at least what we're seeing, you know, my very narrow slice of life. Things like the I do's are, there's no pressure to do it at all. To the contrary, the question is, how many times do you walk around? It used to be that if we would suggest that, conservative rabbis would suggest that, you get tremendous reactions against it. And I would say 95% of the weddings I did for 20 years never had a bride going around a groom. Just it wasn't done. Today I would say 75% of the weddings I officiate at do have that, mostly because the bride and the groom demand it. Go figure. I mean, you tell me exactly why that is, but that would make an interesting paper. So I'm telling you, these things would make interesting papers. The I do's have no place whatsoever in a Jewish ceremony.
Okay. I do not require the civil law.
Civil law in the state of New York, I can only speak for the state of New York, the state of New York accepts religious ceremonies of whatever they are. It does not require anything in the religious ceremony. What it requires is for the officiant to be a duly ordained minister of some church, including the Jewish church, you know, in the language of the state. So, with a few, of course, you know, issues of which you're quite aware, you know, can two women get married, two men get married, does have to be male and female, and those are issues of the day. Surely, if it was solely a religious issue, as you well know, there in many of the religions are perfectly happy to accept things like that. So there are some extra religious things, not many though, really very few. Basically, the state accepts what the religions will offer, with a few rules. We have the rule. First of all, you have to be registered. And that's the key thing. The key thing is a procedural rule. You have to be registered. In New York State, you have to be registered. So what we used to do after ordination, you go down and you register with the city clerk's office, because then you can officiate at weddings. Okay. Now the Gemara reacts to what Rava just said. Rava's very neat and thoughtful solution. Hatam nami kativ. Well, very nice. You just told me that each of these in the scriptures is written, structured differently, and therefore the two writers are structured differently. Fine, that's very nice, but it's not true. It's a good argument, but you pulled out one verse where it is true. I'll give you another verse where it's not true. Okay? Hatam nami kativ, there in terms of the purchase is the purchase of the field. This number 14 is Jeremiah, if I believe right. Jeremiah, where there's a whole section of Jeremiah about the purchase of a tract of land. Well, that's a very significant section of the book of Jeremiah, because Jeremiah is making a purchase of the land of Israel. And it's a statement in Jeremiah, of the redemption of the land. So, atam nami kativ, sadot bakesef yiknu. Fields, people shall buy fields with money. So people shall buy fields with money. That is to say, the scriptural verse is structured in terms of the purchaser and not the seller. We just said that the scriptural verse is structured in terms of the seller and not the buyer. Here is another scriptural verse from Jeremiah where the verse is structured in terms of the buyer and not the seller.
Right? But isn't it really in the terms of the Sadeh? It's the Sadot that's the subject of the sentence.
You're right. You're right. Okay, good. I'm not saying that this argument is going to last, the following. Okay? You'll see the way in which the Talmud really knocks down this argument. It's not a terribly bad argument. The Talmud says, well, don't be so quick to say that it refers to the buyer. It says, Krei be yaknu. You can read this same verse, yiknu, as yaknu. Yaknu means sell. Yiknu means buy. So, what right do you know to tell me that absolutely it means sell? It could mean buy. Because Hebrew is not written with vowels. And the scriptures themselves are not written with vowels. So that, yes, it may be that there is a tradition to read it one way, but it certainly doesn't have to be read that way. Okay, so that's the reaction. It should be yaknu. Yaknu, people shall sell their fields. So it further supports the notion that these things are spoken of in terms of the seller. Okay? Well, of course, once you bring up that kind of an argument, the Gemara we'll see what happens if you apply that argument to the first thing that we read. All right, remember the first, the one about the marriage was ki yikach ish isha, when a man takes a woman for a wife. All right, you're going to fool around and tell me that you can put a patach underneath the yud instead of a chirik underneath the yud, instead of e. All right, well, I'll give it to you. I'll put a patach in front of the other one, which will turn the other one from buy to sell. From buy to sell. Okay.
Yaknu is probably it's more proposed for saying.
Yaknu
will allow it to be sold.
Could be. Good. My tama karid be yaknu. What is the reason that? Second, Krei Beyaknu. Maita Makare Beyaknu. What is the reason that you have chosen to read the word as Yaknu? Mishum Dichtiv Umachar. Because in the first verse cited earlier, it is written, he sells. You're trying to make the two verses work together. So you take the second verse, which seems to contradict the first verse, you change it from Yiknu to Yaknu, and it also means sell. Hachinami kare be kiyikach. If you want to do that, let's go to the other verse. Kiyikach. Okay. All right. Kare be kiyakach. Change that one instead of kiyikach to kiyakach. And what it does, you see, in Hebrew, when you change to the hifil, the causative form of the verb, in these words like to buy, it simply means to cause to buy, which is to sell. So that's a trick that you can play in Hebrew. It works with sachar. To loan, well, in Hebrew, even in English, a little bit vague, I think. To rent or to borrow. One is in the hifil, and the other one is in the kal, as we say. Lahaskir or Sachar. I rented a car today, so today I think Sacharti. The rental company, Hiskirli. Chevrat Machoniot. Hiskirli et Machonit. Okay? So just with the one root, if you turn it into the hefil, it completely turns it around. Right? So, now that's what they're playing with right here. So, achinami kare beki kiyakach. We can do the same thing and go kiyakach.
I want Summerstein's classes.
Mark Summerstein's class, that's a good question. Where is it? It is somewhere here. No, I would doubt the show. I would think it was probably in one of the classrooms. So try 6 and 7. Nobody was downstairs?
I just came right up here.
Oh, because we opened the door. Don't open the door because he knows where it is. Okay. No, I'm like you. I thought it was for the Talmud class. Yeah.
That's the history shows.
Excuse me?
The history shows that it's all for the Talmud
class. Exactly. History shows.
Is he a week early?
No, it starts tonight. I believe, because I think I announced the other day that it starts tonight. Hachinami kare be ki yakach. Also there you could read it ki yakach, dichtiv. And for marriage, we also have another source. Et biti natati la isha zeh. My daughter I have given to this man as a wife. So that speaks from the father's perspective, which is to say the seller's and not the buyer's perspective. Okay? So we thought this was simple. We thought at least that we had two different points of view. You could simply anchor them in two different verses in Scripture, but it's not as easy as it seems. Why?
It's one of the legal practices that the person that writes the deal, or the contract, or the bill of sale, you know, has the edge. There's always an argument in terms of the deal, of, you know, of who's going to write the deal.
I think it's upstairs somewhere in 6 and 7. It's my guess.
It would seem to me that in the question of selling a piece of land or selling a piece of property, okay, it was more important to the seller. Okay, the seller was the one that volunteered to let this go and he gets money. A sale couldn't happen unless the seller was willing. You could be willing to buy something, but you need a seller to make it happen. So the seller is the important one in the sale. And in terms of a marriage, so he would be the one to want to write the deal because mm-hmm. he's getting the money.
Yep.
In terms of the marriage, it would seem to me it was the groom was one because the father's getting nothing. Mm-hmm. He's just getting rid of a daughter.
Well, he's getting something because in this case, remember, he's getting the kiddushi. So he's getting something for it. Okay. But you're basically right. I see where you're going. You say that logic would structure it opposite in those two cases because the more concerned party, who is the one who has to write the document, is really different in these two cases. And that makes perfect sense. All that may be true, and that may be the reason why the Torah is structured in the first place. And Rava's then his citation of sources maybe really points to similar thinking manifested itself in two different verses which work in two different ways. But it would be better to have it smoother. Okay, now Rava comes back and tries to defend his position. Ela amar Rava, hilchata ninhu v'asmachinu rabbanan akrai. A very thoughtful answer of Rava's. Rava says, look, these are two ancient traditions. And this would go with what you were saying, Mark. These are two ancient traditions. Hilchate ninu. The asmachinu rabbanan, and the rabbis attach them to certain biblical verses. So in other words, it's not that the rabbis learn them from the biblical verses. But in fact, these are ancient traditions. And these are ancient traditions that could be for two reasons. One, ancient traditions make sense, just as you explained it. Or, could be that it doesn't have to make sense. If Hilchata can refer to, this is the oral law, goes back to Moses on Mount Sinai, this is the way Moses learned it, excuse me, but it wasn't attached at that time to any particular biblical verses. As is their wont, the rabbis will frequently take the oral law and try to find some source in the written law to attach the oral law to. And when they do that, it's often an imperfect attachment. It's imperfect. Because the reality is that you can have different verses, maybe cited in context, the contexts are different. Or it was just, it didn't mean it as legal verses, that you were, in fact, to learn law from all of these verses. Some verses just give you a narrative perspective, and it didn't really mean to be taken so seriously word for word. Well, how do we know which way to take it? That's a problem in the interpretation of an ancient tradition. Well, in this case, that's really not the issue. The issue is tradition. And tradition structured these two things differently, and the tradition, by virtue of the nature of this tradition, goes back to Moses on Mount Sinai. It's the oral law. Then at a later time, the rabbis tried to attach it to certain biblical verses with greater or lesser success. It's probably pretty good success, but it's not as if they've manufactured this law. Now, there's something very significant in that. If we say that these laws go back to Moses on Mount Sinai, then that means that those laws are issues of Torah. They're clearly issues of Torah. And remember, we had seen early on when we looked at Maimonides' discussion of the three forms of Kiddushin, Kesef, Shtar, and Bi'ah. And we saw that Maimonides very clearly said that first he says these are matters of Torah, and then he backtracks a little bit, and he says Kesef is rabbinic, but the others are matters of Torah. Well, here, this is the source of at least one of these others, the Shtar. Here, it's clear that the Shtar, the documentary form of marriage, is understood then to be essentially an essential part of the oral law. And remember, something that goes back to the Torah doesn't necessarily have to go back to the written Torah. The Torah is conceived in two forms, in an oral form and in a written form. Talmud provides some of the ancient traditions which carry what are the oral forms. But you can imagine that the natural predisposition of the rabbis, as it is for most lawyers, is to look for a written form of something. That's why they will look for that written form. That's how Rava explains what we've got here. Okay? But that means, therefore, that the form of marriage of Shtar clearly goes back to the Torah. And it may mean also that it goes back to the form of sale. The notion of the bill of sale also goes back to the Torah. That's another implication of what is being said here. Because that's another issue in Jewish law, whether a sale is then termed invalid if done in another way, or whether there is sort of a leeway in the law of sales. One of the implications of this is that the law of sales also goes back to Moses on Mount Sinai, and that gives it an awful lot of force. If it's structured so anciently in the law, it has a lot of force to be continued to be structured in that form. If you look down at note number, let's see, I think it's 20 here, is that right? It was the reference to the... Yes, 20. That's 20. According to Run, now remember, Run is on the Hebrew side of the page, is the best of the commentators, as opposed to the normal expectation that it would be Rashi. This is a suspect Rashi. According to Run, the fact that the seller writes a bill of sale while the husband writes a document of Kiddushin is known to be true through tradition. That's the key thing. And is not actually derived from any of the above-mentioned verses. That's to say, Ron's explanation of what Rava is getting at here. By using the plural words ninhu, they are ba'as mechinhu, right? They supported them. They, namely these different traditions, both the traditions of marriage and of the bills of sale, both of them, ninhu, is the who ending in Aramaic is like a final hey mem in Hebrew. By using the plural words ninhu, they are, and ba'as mechinhu, they supported them, The Gemara appears to indicate that both rules, that the seller must write a bill of sale, and that the husband-to-be writes the Kiddushin document, were originally transmitted to Moses. Tosafot, however, argues that only the law of the bill of sale was transmitted in such a manner, while the fact of that the husband writes the document of Kiddushin is derived from the verse Ki Yikach. So there it's interesting, the Tosafot, and the Tosafot are the commentators a generation after Rashi, French commentators, the children and grandchildren of Rashi, okay, one and two generations after Rashi. So they differentiate now between the two types of sale that we're talking about. One is the sale of land, and the other one is the marriage ceremony. Those two documents have different sources. The sale of land is based on the oral law. The marriage ceremony is based on the written law. Okay. Questions, comments?
Okay. Is the implication here that whether we say both part of the altar or only one, somehow what I'm about to say is, this is the way it's always been. We don't really want to change it.
We can't change it.
Either.
Yeah.
We just feel this is the way we've always done it.
Correct. This is.
It works.
Well, it's stronger than that because the assumption is that it works because God made it work. So it's not just that it works. I think there's more force to it even than that. It's more compelling force.
What they say.
Yeah.
It's received law from
yes,
God,
exactly.
Not in the written Torah.
Exactly. It's received law which is not written. And it's not obvious always that that's the nature of Torah. But that is in the rabbinic tradition, Torah can be written or it can be oral. And both are reasonable sources of the divine word.
My question is that a way of saying this is the way it's been since the beginning of time,
mm-hmm.
you might say. So,
maybe
really looking for ways to match. Well, you said you would like to find some written support for it, but even if we don't, or this country,
it doesn't matter.
It's just the way it is.
Correct.
And okay, you could say it's that way because it was that way because God gave that law to Moshe.
Correct.
And
effectively, that's the way it's conceived. There's no way to really, you know, some people would like to prove that. No, in effect, the way the system works is that these things that are so old and over time have that level of sanction to them are just beyond discussion, in effect. Simply because they have that level of sanction to them. How they got it, it's hard to say. You never know. You never know. It's simple to say, well, because there's a direct transmission of tradition from Moses on Mount Sinai. But it seems to me just as easily you could say that at least that's the way we conceive of it and how it actually happened. It's impossible to know this. There's things that happened thousands of years ago, you know, about which you don't have any records. Okay. Now there's an alternative answer. This seemed like a good answer. Maybe I like this answer, but it's surely not the only possible answer. Ibayetema, if you want, I can say, Hatam namikati. There, as far as the sale of the field, it is also written, Ba'ekach et sefer hamikne. I took the bill of sale. Right? English, a verse which decisively proves that the seller is the one who writes the bill of sale. Va'akach et sefer hamikneh. I took the bill of sale. This was the seller who is speaking in this context. So it's, again, before I was saying that sometimes you take a verse out of context and you try to learn law from it. We frequently see that in the Talmud. Here, the context is so compelling that the context itself argues for the logic of that position. With reference to Gidushin, however, Scripture writes, when a man shall take. Right? That also is rather compelling. Because it says it very, it's not as if we're taking anything out of context, or we're just interpreting things in a sort of far-fetched fashion. It's the plain meaning of what it's saying. Right? Which indicates that the husband-to-be is the active party in the Kiddushin process. Okay, we go on. Now Rava, again, our key player here, Rava comes in order to elaborate some of the laws we've sort of left. We've said as much as going to be said about this particular subject that we've just discussed. Now we're going to go beyond that. Rava says in the name of Rav, Amar Rava, Amar Rav Nachman, Katav lo al haniyar, o al hacheres. This is along the lines of what we had read before. If the husband, the groom, writes on paper or on cheres, potsherd, even though the paper or the pachard is not worth a puta, just what we read before, bidcha mekudeshetli, your daughter is mekudeshet to me, bidcha maoresetli, your daughter is maoreset to me, bidcha lila intu, your daughter shall become my wife, bein al yedei aviha, Bein al yedei atzma. Whether this document is accepted by her father or by the girl herself, mikudeshet mida'ato, she becomes betrothed to him as long as it is accepted with the consent of the father. Now this, of course, again, is the child marriage situation. This is structured in terms of that. Vohu shalo bagra, and that, now he makes it very clear in what appears to be a beraita, and this is where the girl has not reached the age of being a bogeret. A bogeret, remember, is 12 and a half. There were really three stages. There was a katana, who is less than 12, the nara, who is 12 to 12 and a half, and the bogeret at the age of 12 and a half. At 12 and a half, she has complete power to determine herself, and the father has nothing to do with it. Right? There is this intermediary period where there's sort of a quasi-type of independence, and then the katana, the minor, has no independence. Okay? No independence in any area, neither in the area of marriage or in any sales. Or any agreements. Agreements made by a minor are not respected by the law. So, Hushala Bagra, this is in a case where the girl has not become a bogeret. The father maintains the rights. Now, notice that the father, there has to be an issue of mikudeshet mida'ato. The father has a level, he has to accept this with his consent. Because remember the issue of da'a, consent in marriage is a very important issue. So here that's made explicit. It's added to the picture. And that was an issue that you had raised before. When you're writing the document, still there has to be an issue. Something has to indicate consent. When you're giving, sometimes it's the giving, or not the giving, but the accepting, that is the indicator of consent. We'll go on with this. Rava goes on. Katav la al hanyar. If the groom writes to her on paper or on a potsherd, afal pi she'ein bo shaveh pruta, same thing. It's worthless. I mean, it's not worth anything. The item it's written on. Hare at mekudeshet li, hare at li leintu, hare at me'oreset li. Any of those formulae which clearly indicate that this kedushin is taking place. Mikudeshet bein al yedei aviha bein al yedei atzma. she becomes betrothed to him, whether the document is accepted by her father or by the woman herself, midaata, with her consent. So in other words, she can consent for her father to accept the document, because she can have an intermediary, as we had read earlier in Montana, and in Jewish law as well. You could have all kinds of people appointed to actually do this. So surely the father can be appointed. But her consent is crucial. Her consent has to be indicated here. Midaata. Vahusha bagra. That is a case where she has reached the age of majority, which is 12 and a half, as far as the laws of marriage are concerned.
Why did they involve the father at the age of 12 and a half?
Correct. Why is the father brought into the picture here? And the commentators ask that question. Of course, in theory, anybody could be brought into the picture, because she can appoint anybody she likes to accept the kedushin on her behalf. So probably most of the commentators say the reason why the father is mentioned here is that you might have thought that it would be generally true, but not true for the father. Because the father always had that power previously. And in fact, what it is saying here is that he could still accept it, but the key thing is it has to be midata. So in a way, by putting these two things together, it emphasizes that while he can accept it, and he is therefore like every other human being,
he's not the main figure.
He's not the main figure, and she has to give permission, and that in a way states very starkly and boldly the transition that has taken place now, where she is responsible for herself and the father is no longer the responsible party. She has to give him permission. And it's not intuitive that the very person whose father could always accept these things could actually say to her father, you have my permission. Right? So that's a major change. Okay. So this is Rava. Now, by Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish then asks, "Shtar erusin shekatavo shelo lishma." So we see that there has to be an issue of consent. Right? The consent is a crucial piece of this, just as it was a crucial piece of the woman accepting the kesef. She has to also be willing to accept this document. Now we come to some of the problems that are peculiar to documents themselves. Shtar erusin sheketavo shelo lishma. What about a document of erusin that was not written specifically lishma for this particular woman? Let's say you have a document.
You found it,
or you bought one that was published. A template, right? It's what do you lawyers say? Lawyers, what is it called? Boilerplate. Well, not only boilerplate, but it's actually, this is a
form.
It's a form document. It's a form. Okay, and the document, because the key thing is that the implication is, since we saw the language, and you correctly asked, don't you have to put the names in it? So that's, you drew out of the language that was stated here, assuming that this is all that you have to say, and in fact, that's all the Talmud's told us. So the implication is that that's right, that's all you have to do. So what if you find one written for somebody else? All right? Now, of course, she's got to accept it willingly. So you could argue, well, that doesn't make any difference. As long as he's willing to give it and she's willing to accept it, what's wrong with that? Okay? Or it could be that, in fact, this has got to be written for this particular marriage at this particular time. That's the question. That's why he asked the question. Ma, what is its status? Now, Reish Lakish analyzes this in terms of the analogies that seem to be relevant here. And here, he'll show us the analogies. Havayot li yitziot makshina. The ways of becoming a wife are analogized to the ways of unbecoming a wife. Right? That is to say that we, and maybe you remember this, early on, we saw that some of the laws of the Kiddushin, were similar to the laws of Gittin. And the fact of writing to begin with, the fact that you can do this transaction through a written document. We early on saw that one of the proofs of that was to learn from the Gittin document, which the Torah says must be written. The Torah specifically says that it has to be written. V'chatav la sefer kritut. He shall write for her a bill of divorcement. V'ayetale ish acher. And she can then become another man's wife. V'yatz'ave'etale ish acher. Thank you. And she shall go out, and then she can become another man's wife. There was a verb, ayeta. Ayeta le'ish acher. Hayeta le'ish acher means she will get married to somebody else. Well, that's in the same discussion, the same sentence, as he shall write for her a bill of divorce. Therefore, the Talmud learned that in fact structurally there are similarities between the bill of divorce and a bill to the extent that there can be a bill in the Kiddushin itself. Well, if that is true, then it may be that there are certain things about that bill of divorce that apply here as well. Let's see whether there are. So that's the reasoning of Reish Lakish. Havayot liyitziyot makshinan. The ways of becoming a wife are compared to the ways of unbecoming a wife. That's the way I translate it. Ma yitziyah be'inen lishma. Since the document of going out, namely the divorce document, must be written lishma for the sake of the woman, af havaya. Be'inan lishma. Also, then, becoming a wife must be written for the sake of the woman. O dilma havayot lahandani makshinan. Or perhaps we compare the various ways of becoming, that is, the methods of kiddushin, to one another. Ma havaya dechesef lo be'inan lishma. In fact, maybe we compare the different methods of kiddushin to one another. And let's take the method of kesef. Does the money have to be minted for this wedding? Of course not. So maybe the document doesn't have to be minted for this wedding. We know, as far as the laws of divorce go, that the document has to be minted for the divorce. You cannot use a standard document for a divorce. Any of you who have seen a get, know that a get is a very complicated legal document. It has to be written specifically. It contains all kinds of information that's relevant to the circumstance, and it has to be a written document. You cannot have a typed get. You cannot have a get come out of the computer. It has to be written for the specific person. The laws of Gittin then are very super specific.
Line the paper.
You better believe it. Very, very specific. The laws of the marriage ceremony might be less specific, but there's a certain degree of lishma, at least. It has to be done for this circumstance. Or maybe, we're not sure. There are two possibilities. If we derive the law of this shtar from the law of the get, then it has to be written lishma for the circumstances, for the specific event. If it can be compared instead to kesef, where you don't have to mint money for the marriage, then you don't have to mint the document either for the marriage. You could use a standard document.
But we did mint for Pidyon Ben.
That's different. It's got its own laws. All right? These we know are to be compared with each other. So we want to see where do we go with this. All right, Rabbi Shimon solves the problem. He raised the problem, and now he's going to solve the problem. Which is the right way to go? Is it more like the get, or is it more like the kiddushin bekesef? Which way is the right way to go? Batar debaya hadar pashta. It's a nice thing the Gemara says once in a while. After he raised the problem, he also solves the problem. That's very nice that after you raise every problem, you can solve it. That's a here about Rabbi Shimon. After he raised the problem, he solves the problem. Havaya litzia makshinan. He is in favor of the first possibility, namely that there is an analogy between the get and the kiddushin. How the amarkra the yatzah v'hayta. The scriptures themselves say the yatzah she shall go out the hayata and she shall be married. So scriptures put these two words right next to each other, and therefore that's about as good a hekesh, as good an analogy that's based on two words being next to each other as the classic mode of rabbinic interpretation. It's about as good as you can find. All right, so here he's got a great hekesh. Hekesh being the technical term of analogy created by proximity. And in fact, the proximity is as close as you can get. Yatzah, she went out. V'hayita.
Is that the same word as heksher?
Excuse me?
It's not the...
Hekesh?
Hekesh and
heksher. Oh, heksher, no. Lahakish is to put something next to. And it can mean an analogy also. Excuse me?
To deduct from one to another.
Yeah, to go from one to another. Okay. Now, just a few words about this. It's a very interesting idea in the wedding ceremony, and it, in fact, carries over even to the ketubah. Keep in mind that, strictly speaking, the ketubah is not a shtar. It is not one of these three methods that we're talking about, strictly speaking. The ketubah is, strictly speaking, the obligations of the groom to the bride. It's an agreement providing obligations, and it's not by any means a mutual obligations. It's only one side. It's the groom's obligations to the bride. Okay? So that is formally what the ketubah is. Truth is, the ketubah that we use also has incorporated into it the words of the shtar. You look at the ketubah that we use, and not that everybody uses the same ketubah. Americans generally use the same ketubah, but Israelis don't use the same ketubah that we do. And our ketubah, among the things that is said in the ketubah is, and the groom said to the bride, "Havi li le'intu, become my wife." So that, in a way, is taking language that we just read, that's the language of the shtar, and putting it into the ketubah. That's not formal ketubah language, it's shtar language. So even though you read in the art school says never, there's no relation between it. The ketubah is a promissory note, the shtar is a completely different note. It's true, but it's not true. It's not quite as dramatic and different as they're making it out to be. So the laws of drawing up the ketubah are similar to this. You cannot use a stock ketubah. There's no such thing as a total stock ketubah. You can't do that. You have to draw it up for this particular event. And that's why if you get a stock ketubah, the stock ketubah is always missing part of the text. And before, when you fill out the ketubah, the first thing that you have to do is I have to read it and then fill in what's missing. There are certain standard things that are usually missing. Toward the end of the ketubah, in the word kanina, I have made a kinyan. Literally, that's what it means. Or we have made a kinyan. There has been a kinyan made. That the word is kanina. The kuf of kanina most commonly will be missing its long piece. And therefore, I will always say to the bride and the groom, you know, if you're concerned, if you have a very beautiful ketubah, let's say, that they want to do in a certain way, I said, remember to bring a pen that's the same color as the ketubah itself. So I tend to use blue ink because I like my signature to look like it wasn't produced by the computer, although the computer, of course, can also produce blue ink. But it's a little bit distinctive. I don't like it to be just another black signature. So I always keep blue ink, and I carry pens. I use pens. So I always, suddenly the leg of the Kuf and Kanina will be blue instead of black if that's the way it is in the ketubah. So just to play safe, if I don't remember to bring a black pen, sometimes I remember, sometimes I don't remember. Other things I have to think about. So I remind them to do something like that. But that's part of the procedure for the drawing up of the ketubah. But the ketubah itself has to be, as we said, what was the language here? The language was Lishma. And Lishma is different than Mida'ata. Da'ata meant it was a question of consent. Lishma means that it has to be drawn up then and there. There has to be something about the document that is done at that time which makes the document specific for this event. So that deals with those issues that you have raised before.
In the ketubah, you said in the ketubah there is a certain part of the shtar for the kiddushin. What about they don't say part of the kiddushin? Like you will give 1,000 shekels in case you will separate her in the.
Oh yes, that's what much of the ketubah is about. It doesn't use that language per se, but it means that language.
It's a divorce agreement.
It's a divorce agreement. The ketubah is basically most. Not the entire ketubah, but much of the ketubah is a divorce agreement. But it's an agreement, the nature of the ketubah is such, the ketubah, I think I've explained this before, I'll just say it briefly, the ketubah solves two basic problems of the law. The problem of the law of inheritance, and the problem of the divorce law. The problem is one of, let's take each one by itself. The problem of the law of inheritance. Law of inheritance is that the child inherits from the father. The wife does not inherit. The children are then responsible for the upkeep of the wife. Okay, that's from the Torah. It's in the book of Devarim, the Midbar. Comes from the story of the Benot Tzlofchad, the daughters of Tzlofchad. And again, it's based on just the way these things are presented in the Torah text, which is so common. And it's obviously a problem way to do things, because what happens then is that the wife is dependent on the children. Even if, in theory, in the modern context, that wouldn't be a major problem, although I don't think it's a good set of affairs. In the ancient context, it was potentially a disaster because a man could have more than one wife. So he could have children from one wife and not from the other wife. And the children of the one wife would, of course, be concerned about their mother. Let's say they don't like the other wife. They could give her a hard time. So it's not a good situation. So by the time the time of the Torah is 1300 BCE. By the time you get to the Talmud, roughly 1,300 years later, 1,000 plus years later, the rabbis write the ketubah. And what the ketubah is if the marriage ends in any way, and it can end in two ways, by death or divorce. If it ends in terms of in death, there is a first lien on the estate, which goes directly to the wife. That's what's written in the ketubah. So since there's a first lien on the estate, liens on the estate have to be paid before the estate is paid. So in other words, she gets paid before the children are paid. And so those monetary stipulations are there. The other side of it was that the ketubah acted also as a way to discourage divorce. Because it was relatively easy to get divorced according to the Torah.
And on what authority did they make that rule 1,000 years later? I mean, where did they come up with that?
The Creator.
They wanted to protect the society.
Basically, it was to protect when they feel that they are protecting the parties to this ceremony, and they can do it. They can't undo the law of the Torah. They just work around it.
Discreet practice in this area.
Well, we know in this particular area, I don't know the answer. We know the Greek practice, and we did that at the beginning of the year, Greek practice as far as marriage goes, which did not, Greek practice and Roman practice, did not give the women any consent. They had no power in it. It was done either by the father or the brother. Fathers and brothers, male members, really entered into all the transactions. Women had no part in the transactions. Startling thing here is the participation of the women.
Is there any precedent in that part of the world for this practice?
I don't know. I just don't know the answer to that. It'd be an interesting thing to say.
Pardon? I just wonder about the spirit of things versus the technicality. So when you say that things have to be drawn up at that moment and they have to be specifically for this couple, it seems to me that continuing a line on the cuff is, you know, a technicality but not really following the spirit of what is being said. So, you know, sometimes I just wonder, it's very clever loopholes to figure out how to do that, but aren't we circumventing something that was supposed to be the intent and the purpose of it? Because just by, you know, extending the line on the cuff at the end is not exactly a tailor-made document.
I'll defend it. I think that some of these laws have some compelling value to them, but frankly, they're not the most compelling issues. You see that when we reflect back on the nature of using a document for kiddushin, per se, using a document, that these are issues that come up with documents. And in fact, once you are forced into the position of reflecting on the document in the smallest way, even in terms of technicalities, you're pushed back to think about the thing. And that may be all that's necessary. It may be all that's necessary to make of it a more compelling issue than in fact it is in practice would be also to turn the law into something that would be ridiculous. I live every day with some of the ways in which law, it's true in our American society, as it is in Jewish law. Matters of law have to be dealt with intelligently. And one of the big problems, I spent all day traveling today. I was in Arizona. Technicalities, the lack of common sense can just drive you crazy when you have legal issues that become part of the public domain. It just makes you completely crazy. At least it makes me crazy. You know, the poor old people, the cripples, the people who at an airport are dealt with as if they are dangerous. And I understand the reasons for these things and non-discrimination and all of those things, but I also think that you shouldn't deal with people in wheelchairs who are 90 years old the same as you should deal with everybody else. You just have to use common sense. There has to be a level of common sense, or otherwise, it's an outrage. And the respect for the law falls apart. That's how I react to it. I tell you that very honestly. And when I see these things, I just get infuriated. But that's the basic problem of law. That, and I don't know what to do about it, except to fight it. But, you know, I know that this, and it's the same thing with moralisms. It's the problem of the moral law. More damage is done by people who try to do good than by people who try to do bad. You understand that? It's a problem that I deal with all the time. It's a preacher's problem. You tell people to do good, and because you have a moral issue, And then you know that somebody's going to take that issue and make and become so moral about it that they're going to destroy lots of decent people and make people absolutely crazy, because they're going to have a moral crusade that's absolutely senseless. Because there's no sechel. There's no sechel. You need to know, you have to be intelligent, and you have to have a certain level of wisdom to function in the world. But that is a commodity that is so unpopular, and it just is in very short supply. So my long answer to your short question is that there's a balance, and sometimes just to have the law in all of its starkness and all of its many, many gruesome details is not the best thing. The greater thing is to do a little bit less of this and a little bit more of that, and in fact, it's for the sake of the law, and it's for the sake of the ultimate purpose of the law. That's arguing the opposite side. Okay?
I think Bobby's question is, it's a good one.
It is too.
But I think, in my perspective on it, I think that the reason that it's trivialized is the fact that most people, really don't know what the document is and what it intends to do and what it really, and what it really says. Mm-hmm. And I think the fault, of that, lies in the liturgy. Is a document. Very few people could read Hebrew, modern American Jews. Fewer could read Aramaic. And to have these ketubas, that are unintelligible to the vast party, of course they're going to be trivialized.
Mm-hmm. Well, everybody laughs when they say the New York, and they're reading it, right? Isn't that a guaranteed line? Because that's the only thing that they can understand to go through all of the, it's a legal document, but then when they say in Hebrew for New York, everybody.
But these issues, this is why I always emphasize to students that it's important to spend time with a couple to explain what all of this is about, because invariably, when people know what it's about, they find it very interesting. I've never had anybody say to me, that's not interesting. It's always the opposite. They say, well, that's so interesting, I can't believe that. Yeah, and I had no idea. Didn't think it had any meaning at all. And now that you explain it to me, it's very interesting.
Is there anything in Jewish marriage law in the wider sense of it, like annulment?
Annulment, yes. Hafka'at kedushin, it is called. There is such a thing. Hafka'at kedushin. There is such a notion in Jewish law, yeah.
Does it have to be in Aramaic? Can it be in English?
Can we call it an annulment?
Yes. No, I meant the ketubah.
Oh, the ketubah? The ketubah is traditionally done in Aramaic. It is done in America frequently in English. It is done these days also frequently in Hebrew. But this is so many other things in the wedding ceremony. Tradition plays a major part in a wedding ceremony. No matter what tradition you want. Tradition itself is a major part of a wedding ceremony. So the truth is that sometimes things that are quaint, that they go back to Aramaic sources, that they have their roots in the Talmud, that fact in itself, if one is aware of that, one brings into it a sense of tradition. And that has its independent value. Let's keep going. I want to get to a certain point.
With the leaven, when we pronounce the leaven before Pesach, we have to do that in our vernacular. Mm-hmm. And it would seem to me that if that's the case, then getting married would also dictate the need for the vernacular.
That you have to know what you're saying.
I'm wondering whether or not the Aramaic tradition isn't from the fact that that was the vernacular.
No doubt about it.
So the tradition trumps the Aramaic over the vernacular, but it may derive from.
It's also true for Hebrew. Hebrew was the vernacular at a certain time, which is why it was in the Bible. You know, because it's not the vernacular at this point, you know, a lot has happened since then. So their tradition now has an independent argument for itself. You know, how would it be if you told a mourner that he has to get up and not say Yit Gadal? I even have mourners who are upset when I say Yit Gadal as opposed to Yis Gadal. Okay? Because it's tradition that really is what's meaningful and moving, as opposed to what the words mean. Words. Or how would it be if instead of saying Kol Nidre V'Yesarei, we got up and said, all vows that you have vowed. Tradition comes to have its own power. Okay, moving on. Itamar, it is said. It is said, Kitavo Lishma V'Shalom Midata. Okay, here we're going with, we now have two concepts. Concept of Lishma, right, for the sake of this particular woman in this particular wedding, right? And we have the other concept is Midata, that it has, there has to be consent. So now we have Kitavo Lishma, if a Kedushin document was written for the sake of the woman who receives it, but was written without our knowledge, right? Not in front of her, that document that came from elsewhere. Rava Ravina Amre Mikudeshet. Rava and Ravina both say that it's Mikudeshet, that it's kosher.
As long as she's an Ara or a child.
Well, that's not the issue. The issue here is Lishma. That is, while you say it's important, it's not that important. Okay? Because this is it's Lishma Ushalomidata, without our knowledge. I'm just saying. Oh, sorry. No, this is the note is important here. Notion of data, as understood by Rashi here, is different. All right? Look at note 3. If the man did not consult her before the document was written, but informed her of its existence later. Okay? That's Rashi's interpretation. That's fair. Rav and Ravina say that it's kosher, and Rav Papa and Rav Shravya Amre Eina Mekudesha. It's not kosher. Amara Papa Emata Madidhu Ve Emata Didi. I will tell you their reasoning and I will tell you my reasoning. That's a good way to go about it. I can tell you what we both think. Emata Madidhu, I'll tell you their reasoning. Yichtiv, it's written Viatza Vahaita. She shall go out and she shall be married. She will be. Makish Havayala Yitzia. These two things are put together. Being, namely the Kiddushin, is compared to leaving a divorce. Ma Yitziyah Lishma. As the divorce has to be for Lishma, Ushalomidata, remember that as far as divorce in the Torah goes, the woman made, her consent is not crucial for divorce in the Torah. The divorce that we have, yes. Rabbis add the consent issues. But as far as the Torah goes, that is not a part of the notion of divorce. So since the two of them, there is the analogy between divorce, so divorce does not require consent, so marriage does not require the consent, or at least this aspect of it. Mayitziyah lishma, ushalomidata, afavayan nami lishma mishalomidata. The emata medidi, and now I'll tell you my reasoning. Piatz avaita, based on the same verse, she will leave and she will be. Then we shall get married. Makish havayali yitzia. There is an analogy between getting married and getting divorced. Ma yitzia beinan daat makneh. Just as the document of leaving, the bill of divorce, needs to be written with the assent of the giver. Namely, the husband has to agree to the divorce in the Torah. Husband has to, so too the document of marriage, the Kiddushin document, needs to be written with the assent of the giver, in this case, the woman. Because remember, the marriage and divorce are different in this case. Let's see, I think the seven explains it, if I remember. In the condition process, the woman is considered the giver because she becomes acquired by her husband. Right? He's the acquirer. So she's the giver here, at least as he's arguing for it. Meitebe. They then challenge Ravam Ravina's ruling from a Mishnah, which states, Ein kodvin shtarei arisin v'nisuin ele mida'at shnehem. We have read that before. You cannot write documents of erusin or nisuin without the assent of both parties. My love, shtare erusin v'nisuin mamash. Now, doesn't this refer to really what we're talking about? A shtar of kiddushin? A written document that makes kiddushin? Well, the answer is no. Lo, shtare pesikta. This refers instead to documents of allotments. I think that's explained coming up. The financial conditions for a forthcoming marriage can be finalized in the following way. Before the kiddushin, the father of the bride says to the father of the groom, Kama ata noten lebincha. How much are you giving for your son? Groom, father answers, kach v'chach, such and such. Levivcha, they turn it around. How much are you giving for your daughter? The bride's father answers, kach v'chach, such and such is what I am giving. Amdu v'kidshu v'kanu. They then stand up and carry act an act of kiddushin. Ein hein advarim aniknin ba'amira. These are the obligations that are being made legally binding through speech alone. So this is what was being referred to as shtare pesikta. These are the kinds of family obligations that are entered into by the families at that time. And therefore the assent issue that was being referred to up above was not the assent for this shtar that we're talking about, a document that makes kiddushin, but it's an assent rather for these financial arrangements, right, that precede the kiddushin. Okay? So simply you didn't have the context of the brayta right. The context was not vis-a-vis what we're talking about. It was a vis-a-vis another type of transaction that goes on in a marriage between the families of the bride and the groom. Okay? So that simply closes the matter, in effect. And that closes the discussion then of shtar, kiddushin bishtar, that you can make a kiddushin with a written document. Questions? We will continue next week and move on to Bia.
Thank you.
Making progress.
I have a question.